Today is Monday, September 28th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, startling revelations in a damning new report Sunday on President Trump's taxes.
It's totally fake news, made up fake.
Trump faces off in the first presidential debate against Joe Biden on Tuesday night. Also ahead, the mental health toll of the COVID-19 pandemic. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump paid just $750 in federal income taxes the year he ran for president and in his first year in the White House, according to a report Sunday in the New York Times. According to the Times, Trump, who has fiercely guarded his tax filings, paid no federal income taxes in 10 of the past 15 years. But at a White House news conference on Sunday, Trump pushed back, dismissing the report.
First of all, I paid a lot, and I paid a lot of state income taxes, too. The New York State charges a lot, and I paid a lot of money in state. It'll all be revealed. It's going to come out. But after the audit.
The disclosure, which the Times said comes from tax return data it obtained extending over two decades, comes at a pivotal moment ahead of the first presidential debate Tuesday. Trump has fought numerous court challenges seeking access to his returns. He is the only president in modern times not to make them public. A lawyer for the Trump Organization, Alan Garten, released a statement saying that the president has paid tens of millions of dollars in personal taxes to the federal government, and that most, if not all, of the facts in the Times article appear to be inaccurate. The first presidential debate pitting President Trump against former Vice President Joe Biden takes place Tuesday in Cleveland, Ohio. This is the first of three debates in which the two will appear face to face. The election campaign is close, but nationally and in Ohio, a swing state where voters' opinions about the two candidates differ sharply from one household to the next. VOA's Carolyn Pursuti is in Cleveland for the debate.
This Trump flag was the first sign of politics in this Ohio neighborhood.
I debated whether to put it up or not because I was afraid my house might get shot at. And then I thought, you know what? I'm not living in fear.
But then, across the street, a Biden supporter, a friend of 44 years.
Whoever is going to be in charge just needs to lead us and be nice and smart and democratic.
Yeah, hope the best man wins.
I didn't think that.
Oh, he will.
Ohio is a crucial state. No Republican has ever won the presidency without winning Ohio. President Trump won the state by 8 points in 2016. But this year, polls show only a few points separating him from Democratic challenger Joe Biden, as neighbors and sometimes families split their allegiance.
Half of my kids are Trump supporters, so we don't invite them over anymore, no. They can't come over until next year, so, you know what I mean? So we say we aren't going to talk about politics, even though we do, and then we stop it.
Across the country, polarization of Trump and Biden supporters can deeply affect families. Case Western Reserve's Joe White teaches American politics and the presidency.
Republicans are more upset about the possibility of their child marrying a person of the same gender or who is transgender. Democrats are much more upset about the idea of their child marrying a Republican.
I'm going to get a wheel put riding with Biden, too. I think I'm going to decorate the whole front lawn. No.
How about hiding with Biden?
Dolores Gentile says her friendship with Patty Lucci rises above politics.
I like Trump. They like Biden. So what? One of them's going to win.
The first presidential debate Tuesday at Case Western Reserve University, not far from their houses, is expected to be contentious.
Vice President Biden will presumably be trying to walk a fine line of some sort, but he also wants to find ways to make Trump look as bad as possible, which may mean baiting him.
The debate venue in Cleveland awaits the two men to discuss their records, the Supreme Court, the coronavirus pandemic, election security, and the economy. Another topic, racial justice protests that have at times triggered rioting and looting.
That's why I'm voting for President Trump, because it seems like the Democratic Party has not condemned any of this.
I just think Trump says, I think he's mean. That's what I think upsets me. I think he says really mean things.
A new poll shows 2 out of 3 Ohio voters agree that politics has strained relationships among families and friends. Many say they cope by avoiding any election talk. Instead, they will leave the real debating to the two candidates Tuesday here at this pavilion. Carolyn Presutti, VOA News, Cleveland, Ohio.
Yemeni government and Ansar al-Houthi representatives have agreed to immediately release 1,081 conflict-related detainees and prisoners. The agreement was reached at the conclusion of 10 days of UN-mediated talks in the Swiss city of Glion. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
This agreement, when implemented, will be the largest prisoner release between Yemen's warring parties since they signed a pact to swap some 15,000 prisoners and detainees in Stockholm in 2018. The UN Special Envoy for Yemen, Martin Griffiths, urges the parties to move forward immediately with a prisoner exchange and spare no effort in building upon this momentum to swiftly agree to releasing more detainees.
And releasing those detainees will bring immense relief and comfort to more than 1,000 families who will be reunited with their loved ones because of your acts and your decisions. It will bring reassurance and hope to many more families still awaiting the release of their loved ones and their friends.
So far, the warring parties have released only a few hundred prisoners. In unilateral moves, the Houthis last year freed 290 prisoners and Saudi Arabia 128. The United Nations calls Yemen the world's worst humanitarian disaster. The fighting involves the Iranian-backed Houthi rebels who control Sana'a, the capital, and much of the country's north, and a U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition fighting on behalf of the internationally recognized government. Since Saudi Arabia entered the war in support of the government in 2015, the UN reports more than 10,000 civilians have been killed and wounded, mainly due to airstrikes, while more than 85,000 have lost their lives due to disease or hunger. The UN also says another 3.6 million have been displaced and 24 million need international aid. The International Committee of the Red Cross, which co-sponsored the talks, calls the agreement signed Sunday a very positive first step. The ICRC Regional Director for the Near and Middle East, Fabrizio Carboni, says his agency, as a neutral intermediary, is happy to use its expertise and experience to facilitate the release and repatriation of detainees.
We call on all parties to continue this with the same urgency towards agreeing on phasing of legs as well as require security and logistical guarantees for this operation to move from signature to reality.
The UN and Red Cross co-sponsors of this meeting say they hope the talks will send a message that much can be accomplished when parties to a conflict are willing to compromise and show good faith. They urge the warring parties to build on this important achievement to move together toward a negotiated solution for lasting peace. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kazimi has struggled to clamp down on the Iran-backed paramilitary groups widely believed to be responsible for launching dozens of rockets at Baghdad's Green Zone and Iraqi facilities hosting U.S.-led coalition forces. During his August 19th meeting with Kazimi, President Trump said he plans to withdraw U.S. troops, though didn't give a specific time frame. Paramilitaries have continued to call for a full withdrawal and maintained their rising number of attacks from 4 in May to 18 in August. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi spoke to Ismail al-Sudani, former Iraqi military attaché in Washington, about the developments.
They are associated to political parties linked to Iran, and therefore they are trying to making their Iran agendas in Iraq soil. These militias gain popular support by manipulating the sentiments of the people because they are part of the force. They have contributed positively to defeat ISIS. That's why it is essential in fighting these militias is by separating them among popular mobilization units, which are submitted to the government order. I believe the appropriate approach to weaken Iran-backed militia, the prime minister has to set a multi-pronged strategy to fight any out-of-state-controlled militia. Prime Minister Al-Kazemi needs to start a national dialogue with the political parties and all national components and activities to isolate these militias from their bases. He requires to separate them from the political parties associated to them. That would not be possible without political consensus to fight all these groups. And of course, law and order enforcement, that means executing a military operation to confront these groups that not abiding by the government orders and national consensus.
Prime Minister Al-Kazemi is attempting also to counter the pro-Iranian paramilitaries financially by strengthening government control over border crossing to fight corruption and smuggling. Could that curtail the paramilitaries' income sources?
I doubt this step would restrict the paramilitaries' funds to curb their activities, as the border crossing is not the only way to finance them. There are various illegal means and ways, such as oil smuggling, corruption, and ghost soldiers. As I said, they are part of the Iraqi government, so they have their own entity, they have their own organizations. They are having kind of ghost soldiers. There are thousands or hundreds of thousands of them have been manipulated by the popular mobilization or by these militias. That helped them to fund their activities, not to mention the extortion, abduction, and organized crime. Also, they are owned by political parties, which are carbon paper, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Forces scheme in controlling on the private sector companies and government contracts. Therefore, Prime Minister would face a fierce confrontation to curtail these militias. It's not only by controlling on the crossing borders.
During his August 19 meeting with Kazemi, President Donald Trump said that he plans to withdraw U.S. troops without specifying a date. Paramilitaries have, meanwhile, continued to call for a full withdrawal of the U.S. forces and maintain their rising number of attacks from 4 in May to 18 in August. Would that pressure the U.S. troops to withdraw, especially that President Trump promised to bring back all American troops from the Middle East?
Since ISIS defeat in Iraq, the U.S. and Iraqi government have had agreed to draw down the number of U.S. forces in Iraq. Until August 2020, the number has been decreased from 12,000 to 5,000. On September 2020, the number down to 3,500. The remaining forces have evacuated almost all the bases to Iraqi forces except two main bases in areas out of the militia reach and control. President Trump, as part of his re-election campaign, is keen to attract more votes by announcing the drawdown in Iraq and Afghanistan. But I don't think that the militia attacks against U.S. forces and U.S. embassy in Baghdad would enforce the full withdrawal before the election.
Ismail al-Sudani, former Iraqi military attaché, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed al-Shanawi. Masked police dragged people into vans and fired stun grenades and tear gas to disperse crowds as tens of thousands marched for a seventh straight weekend to demand veteran Belarusian leader Alexander Lukashenko quit. Protesters chanted "Imposter" and "Sveta is our president" as they marched through Minsk and other cities decked out in red and white opposition colors. At least 200 people were detained, according to the Interior Ministry. Work has resumed at three of Libya's five oil port facilities after an eight-month hiatus. Two ports have yet to resume work, however, including Libya's largest, the Al-Sharara oil field. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Libyan media reported sporadic militia clashes in the capital, Tripoli, but the resumption of oil production at three of the country's main oil ports overshadowed the security situation amid public anguish over lengthy power cuts and problems with other services.
Oil Facilities Protection Forces Chief General Naji Maghrebi told Arab media that oil pumping has resumed at Libya's Zweitina, Brega, and Hareka ports, while facilities at two other ports at Sidra and Ras Lanuf remain offline, along with the El Sharara oil fields, which are controlled by Eastern Military Commander General Khalifa Haftar's military forces. Resumption of oil production was part of a deal between General Haftar and Ahmed Maitik, Deputy Prime Minister of the rival Tripoli government. Fayez Sarraj, who heads the UN-backed government in Tripoli, told the UN General Assembly Thursday it was imperative to reopen Libya's port facilities.
He says that all militias should return to their countries and Libya's seaports and oil fields, which he claims were closed due to foreign pressure, must reopen. Their closure, he adds, caused financial losses estimated at $9 billion and serious damage to infrastructure. Libyan media reported that engineers and other oil production workers are now being allowed to resume work and that flights between Tripoli's Maitika airport and the Haftar-controlled city of Sirte now have resumed. Libyan analyst Aya Burwaila, visiting lecturer at the Hellenic National Defense College, tells VOA the resumption of oil pumping is a very positive development that will help tackle the electricity crisis and provide immediate relief for the suffering of Libyan citizens. Development in civilian infrastructure projects have long been stalled due to what she calls the abuse and unwillingness of the Tripoli government to subject itself to audits and agree to a fair distribution of oil revenues. Khatar Abu Diab, who teaches political science at the University of Paris, tells VOA the oil resumption deal between rival Libyan governments was a parallel political effort between Libya's power centers alongside the U.S. effort to jumpstart political talks in Morocco between the Islamist head of Tripoli's ruling council, Khaled Misri, and Eastern Libya-based Parliament Speaker Akila Saleh. The oil production resumption deal between Eastern Military Commander General Khalifa Haftar and Tripoli's Deputy Prime Minister Ahmed Maitik, he says, comes amid uncertainty over who controls the levers of power in Tripoli and efforts by Maitik and Haftar to maintain their current positions in a future political shuffle. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
France has opened a terrorism investigation following a knife attack Friday that seriously wounded two people near the old Paris offices of Charlie Hebdo newspaper. Lisa Bryant reports from the French capital. The two suspects have been detained.
The parallels between the January 2015 attack on Charlie Hebdo and this latest one are chilling. Once again, journalists were targeted, two members of French production agency Première Ligne, who were stabbed as they took a cigarette break outside. The group worked in the same building as Charlie Hebdo's old headquarters before the 2015 incident, and the attack happened as a trial is underway for suspected accomplices in the Charlie Hebdo killings.
L'auteur principal.
Speaking to journalists at the scene, Paris prosecutor Rémi Heitz said the police have arrested two people, including the alleged leader of these latest strikes. And because of all the parallels with the Charlie Hebdo attacks 5 years ago, he said, anti-terrorist prosecutors are investigating it. Islamist assailants killed 12 people during the January 2015 strikes, including prominent Charlie Hebdo cartoonists.
C'est l'occasion pour le gouvernement de la République.
Prime Minister Jean Castex reaffirmed France's support for press freedom and its determination to fight terrorism using all possible means. Charlie Hebdo has recently received new death threats, with French media signing an open letter backing the newspaper and free expression. Friday morning, a suspicious package reportedly arrived at the weekly newspaper's old offices. Police briefly cordoned off the site of the attack while a small crowd looked on.
Ils en veulent à la France parce que elle est là-bas en Afrique à l'opération Barkhane.
A 72-year-old Parisian named Gérard, who declined to give his last name, said he believed France was being targeted because of its Barkhane anti-terrorist force in Africa's Sahel region. Another local resident, Li Li, who recently moved here from China, was unable to get home because of police blockades.
It's so difficult to live in here because now we have COVID and economic downturn, and now we have this.
Il y a plus la même légèreté comme avant.
Delivery man Louis Cuevas says people no longer feel at ease here. You have to check for suspicious bags on public transport, be careful on the street, and now COVID-19. We're living in unhealthy times, he said. The attack comes as the government is readying new legislation to fight so-called separatism, what it considers enemies of France and its way of life, including radical Islam. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
North Korea offered a rare apology Friday after the killing of a South Korean civilian official near the two Koreas' sea border. The apology reduces the risks of a major military escalation on the Korean peninsula. VOA's Bill Gallo has more. From Seoul.
South Korea's military on Thursday accused North Korea of shooting and immediately cremating an official who may have been trying to defect to the north. The killing, according to Seoul, was gruesome. After intercepting the man at sea, North Korean forces shot the man to death, doused his body with oil, and lit him on fire, South Korea said. South Korea's military demanded an apology. To the surprise of many here in Seoul, they actually got one. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un said he is greatly sorry for the unsavory incident, which should not have happened. That, according to a North Korean statement released by the South Friday. The 47-year-old went missing Monday from his patrol boat about 10 kilometers south of the de facto inter-Korean border. Seoul officials suspect the man, who had reportedly struggled with debt and other personal issues, jumped overboard. North Korea admits killing the man, but denies setting him on fire. Instead, they claim they burned his flotation device in accordance with strict coronavirus guidelines. North Korea has reportedly issued shoot-to-kill orders to prevent the coronavirus from entering the country. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
And AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour. Oh. Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world.
Ah.
Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. The COVID-19 pandemic, along with its economic impact, is raising concern about the state of mental health, especially among the vulnerable in Nigeria. With stories of job losses and amid lockdowns and restrictions, everyday Nigerians are facing increased risks of various forms of mental health issues, according to mental health experts. As Samuel Okocha reports from Lagos, although the worst of the pandemic may be over with, mental health advocates say the effect of the pandemic may be far from over.
Lukman Olabisi is a tailor. He earns his living making clothes for residents around a small shop here in Lagos. But since the coronavirus pandemic began, business has not been the same.
Sometimes you may open a shop down, which you will not even see a single one person to call you and say, I want to sew. But as a man, you don't sit down and say, God will help you. You have to go out to also to make sure you don't sit at home. Sitting at home will cause a lot of problem for a family man that have 4 kids.
Due to the falling income from his tailoring business, Lukman now works, sleeps, and wakes up in his workshop for most of the week to save cost on what has now become an expensive daily commute to his home.
It's not been easy for a man that has been going home to his family to stay together, now become a man that will sleep in the shop from Monday till Saturday before he go home. It's not been easy, but I believe once there's life, there's still hope. Because you cannot kill yourself. You don't say because things is not going well, you have to commit suicide. No.
Lukman is hopeful in spite of his precarious financial situation. But his story highlights a major concern about mental health in the pandemic amidst worsening social economic conditions.
Because a lot of people have had a number of losses this period. A number of people have lost their jobs. A lot of people have had great losses in their businesses. We actually anticipate that more and more people would need mental health support.
Ife Dayo Ward is the executive director of Mentally Aware Nigeria Initiative, a non-profit organization raising awareness on mental health and illnesses in the country. Over the past months since the pandemic began, Ife Dayo and our organization have been providing remote counseling services to an increasing number of people seeking mental health support.
Apart from depression, the next highest number of cases came from people coping with anxiety disorder.
Ife Dayo said the COVID-19 pandemic had triggered existing mental health conditions for many Nigerians, but added the economic impact of the pandemic could have a far-reaching effect. She says more action is needed from relevant stakeholders to avert what she calls a mental health pandemic.
We're already witnessing a surge in number of suicidal cases or attempted suicides in the country right now. It is very important that we all come together as stakeholders to create a Nigeria where mental health services are available to everybody, regardless of their socioeconomic class, religion, or their tribe, or orientation.
Samuel Okocha, VOA News, Lagos, Nigeria.
Yesterday.
And it's been 50 years since the Beatles, possibly the most influential band of all time, broke up. To mark the anniversary, Sotheby's is auctioning a collection of artifacts that trace the rise of Beatlemania and its enduring influence over the last 60 years. The sale includes a pair of round Windsor spectacles worn by late singer and guitarist John Lennon. The glasses are expected to fetch up to 40,000 British pounds. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great day.
Such an easy game to play.